So here we go. The mindfulness of the body. Okay. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So, yesterday we did the first of the mindfulness of the body. Now remember that each one of these are four focuses of mindfulness, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful, you're aware of the body. And one of these ones was on the breath. Now, another way is the four postures. You got on those? Are we on the four postures? Four postures. Where you go? You got four postures yet? Three's good enough. But now you got the four, okay. When walking, you are aware in the present that I am walking. When standing, sitting or lying down, you're aware in the present that I am lying down. Thus you maintain present moment awareness, however your body is disposed. There are sometimes you're not really laying down, you're not sitting, you're in between. It is called the slouching posture. So these four postures, they are not exclusive. There's always in between somewhere. And this is just, you know, where you are, what you're doing, and why you're doing it. In this way, you're aware of your own body, the different postures of the body, aware that bodies of others are the same nature as yours. You abide aware of both your own and others' bodies. So you're nothing special. You're just a body. And or else you abide of what causes the arising of the body. And you're aware that the body will cease when the four nutriments cease. You abide contemplating the body's causal nature of both arising and ceasing. Or else mindful is just a body, that's all. Impermanent, suffering or not, me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That's another way that you are mindful of the body. Now, I think yesterday there was a question about what does that all really mean. So I'm just going to go down a little bit to, where have we got? The arising and passing away, the rise and fall of the body. Have you got that? It goes down a bit. It's at the end of the mindfulness of the body section, before the mindfulness of experience section. Past the bodily parts. Past the benefits. Yay! So, the rising and passing away, the rise and fall. Now, the Satipatthana Suttas, which are most quoted, are again from the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, and also from the middle length sayings, the Majjhima Nikaya. The first is called the Mahasatipatthana, the second is just the ordinary Satipatthana. But there is also in the Samyutta Nikaya, the collected discourses, there's also a whole section on the Satipatthana. And there we get even more information on what the Satipatthana means. And there we answer the question where it says up here that the rising and falling, where is it? So else you're aware what causes the arising of the body, you abide aware the body will cease, or you abide contemplating the body's arising and passing away. And many people who study or practice Satipatthana, they know that's one of the important parts noticing rising, passing away, or both rising and passing away. And it's not really explained to them what that really means. It's not just sitting by a lake watching the waves, it comes and goes, or watching the heat. Sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's cold, and sometimes it's light, sometimes it's dark. Yeah, things come and go. But satipatthana means understanding why. What causes these things to come? What causes these things to go? And so that's explained in the sutta from the Satipatthana, the arising and passing away. This is in the Satipatthana Samyutta. I will teach you the origination, it's called samudaya, and a passing away, atagamana. I did mention the idea of the atta, that means going to its conclusion, it's where it goes to, where it comes from is dhamma, where it goes to is the atta. The going of the four focuses of mindfulness. Supported by the four nutriments, there is the origination and continuance of the body. With the cessation of the four nutriments, the body ceases. And the four nutriments are food. If you don't eat, you die. And that's obvious. The six sense contacts, that you have to actually just to experience stuff. Otherwise, people tend to pass away. It's one of these, you may have a healthy body, but if there's no sense stimulation, then you pass. And this is much the case if someone, if you have a loved one who's in a coma, in hospital, and if they really are not be able to receive any stimulation, you know, from the five external senses of like body, of like some sight, hearing, smell, taste, or touch, that they will pass away, even though there may be nothing really physically wrong with them. Or, you know, the heart might still be beating, but if there is no reception of any sense stimuli, then they will pass away. Which is one of the reasons why, you know, knowing this, if you have a loved one in hospital, and, you know, you want them just to continue on, speak to them. They may not be responding to you, or you think they're not responding, but you just tell them all the news, all the gossip, anything. Just speak to them so that, you know, they're giving them some hearing stimulus. Or even better is actually you touch them, stroke their arm, or whatever, to give them some stimulus. Because otherwise, without that sensory stimulus, they will pass away. That's one of the fuel, for this body to continue. It needs to be stimulated. The passa. Yeah. For the mind it's something completely different because your body dies, but that sixth sense continues on. So a person can be actually in a deep meditation, and sometimes can they pass away? Sometimes they can. I got this wonderful picture on my shrine in my office up there, and there was a monk. No one knows who he was. He was found in a cave in the north of Thailand. And he was in a full lotus position. The only reason they knew he was a monk, there was just a shred of brown cloth around him. He hadn't been eaten by any animals. And he was in a perfect posture, and his skin had just dried around him. And in those days, it was, I know this, that a monk who was going to spend the rains retreat in a cave or in the jungle would always have to check in with the senior monk in the district, first of all. And all the senior monks in the district hadn't heard of this monk at all. So they said it was certainly before our time. And that was like maybe 100 years, 150 years. Still perfectly preserved. And It was a lovely little photograph. He'd obviously died in a deep meditation. And just perfect posture. Maybe if I can get hold of that, I'll bring it tomorrow for you. It's a really cool photo. Obviously, the photo was many, many years after he passed away, but there it is. So anyway, that sixth sense contacts. The last three is will. You need the will to survive. Because sometimes when people decide they've had enough, sometimes that people lose the will to live. And they pass. And sometimes I've experienced this. Sometimes the people in hospital, and you see that they should be dead. But they're waiting for someone to come from overseas. And then when their sister comes from overseas, they say, and they smile, and then they pass away. They keep themselves going just for something which is important to them. So that sometimes happens. So the will, and the last one, the consciousnesses. It's the same as the sixth sense contacts. Something to be able to actually the objects of the senses, but also the sense basis. So if your sense of sight is destroyed, and if the hearing is gone, so you're deaf and you're blind, and also you can't feel the body, if that sense is taken off, and smell and taste, notice, not very powerful senses, then you're dead. Because there's nothing to keep you going in this world. So those, the Buddha said, were the four causes for the arising of this body, its maintenance, just like the three causes for a candle flame, the heat, the wick, and the wax. These four upadanas. When these, they call it ahara foods, when these four foods are stopped, or even sometimes just one of them, then the body stops. That's what I mean by the rise and fall. It's not up to you, it's just cause and effect. So you're understanding what they say over here. I'm going to go back to the four postures, and the end of the four postures. You abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, that the body will cease when these four nutriments cease. And you just abide contemplating the body's cause and nature, both arising and ceasing, according to causes. Or else, just mindful, it's just the body, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. I often say, who does your body belong to? It belongs to nature. Cause and effect, not yours. So sometimes you get sick at the most inconvenient times. It's really awful, isn't it? People are on holiday, and that's when they get sick. If I only could get sick when I was at work, like an extra time. And so it's not me, it's out of control, our body. So it's not just a body, that's all. And it's not your permanent essence. We don't worship the body, we look after it. We care for it. And the next one, after the four postures, we have the full comprehension of the purpose. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when going forward and returning. What are you doing that for? You act in full comprehension of the purpose when looking ahead or looking away, when flexing and extending your limbs, when wearing your clothes and carrying things. You act in full comprehension of the purpose regarding eating, drinking, defecating and urinating, walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking and keeping silent. And in the standard Satipatthana translation, which I first read as a young monk, it said you act mindful when you're sleeping. And that caused a lot of problems when we said, well, we've got to be mindful when we sleep. How can you do that? And so then we started investigating lucid dreaming, when you've got some sort of mindfulness when you're asleep. And that was just really difficult. And, you know, sometimes you could do it, sometimes you couldn't. It was just, well, are you really lucid? Are you not lucid? But you weren't getting a good night's sleep. Is that what you're supposed to do to get enlightened? And then you check the Pali. It was the comprehension of the purpose. It's why you're sleeping. What are you doing it for? Is it to escape? Because they used to tell me down in the prison, that in the prisons sometimes they liked sleeping as much as they could. Because they had the saying, one extra hour of sleep is 1 hour off your sentence. And it's, you know, interesting, that's what the prisoners used to tell me. So they would try and sleep as much as they could. So they're blotting out the fact they were in jail. But that's, you know, that's not what we do as a monk or a nun or as a in jhana grove. So why are you sleeping? And sometimes the why you're sleeping is again to relax the body, to make it sort of fresh again. So if you can't sleep at night, a lot of trouble is because you've got to get up at a certain time in the morning. Oh my goodness. I've got to get up, you know, to do the work tomorrow morning. If I don't get to sleep now, I'll be really tired in the morning. Ah! And it's so wonderful when you can get up any time you like. Which means you can go to sleep any time you like. Which means you sleep without all this force and this striving and this pressure on you. I often say that a lot of times that people in our modern world, many of the sicknesses and anxieties and depressions come from people that just don't know how to sleep well, or they don't have the opportunity to sleep. That's why just coming to a place like this and practicing for the first couple of days, not meditation, but Garfield's meditation. In other words, it's relaxing. And I told somebody during the interviews that sometimes, you know, I have a good night's sleep. You wake up in the morning, you just meditate, and, you know, you go and have a breakfast, and then you've got a free morning, and sometimes I'm really tired. I've already slept enough. But, you know, I'm sort of aware enough of my body now. There are some times, I don't know what the reason is, but I'm really tired. I can't find a reason, but I still listen to my body. And if I can, go to my room and just stretch out and take a nap. You know what happens? Maybe only an hour, 45 minutes, you wake up afterwards, you feel so relaxed and so energized. And I started thinking, if it's indulgence, you just lay down and you can't go to sleep. And you don't need to. But if it really is the fact you need some rest, for some reason or another, you go to sleep straight away. And you just wake up just feeling really good. And I think that's a lot of time. You may have like a flu or a cold or some other stuff. And the body knows before you know. And the body says, please take me to bed, have a rest, so I can fix this up. And that's one of the reasons that you have an opportunity to have really good health. You're listening to your body. You're aware of it. And the body is telling you what it needs. And you have the opportunity to listen to that advice and follow it. But if you go to bed and you're just tossing and turning, can't go to sleep, that is just, you know, trying to escape. That's indulgence. But if you hit the pillow and you're gone, that's really cool. So anyway, that's the reason why you're sleeping. Why you're eating. I eat to be a field of merit, so people can give me stuff and make merit. That's why I'm fat. So drinking, defecating. Oh, drinking. Now sometimes that people, they think, oh well, you know, just when you get old, you've got to get up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet because your retention abilities is not as good when you were young. So they think, I better not drink so much tonight. And then you dehydrate and get sick. Or you want to do long meditations. And so, well, you know, the Buddha never had to get up, you know, just before the first jar to go to the toilet, but so you don't drink so much. But look, you have to drink to be healthy. So a lot of times, you know, people just get sick. Again, simple things. Thank you. Well done. It's nice to see someone following the instructions. He had a swig of water. And I've got to walk my talk. When you hydrate yourself, it's very good for your health. Simple things. It's much cheaper than going to the doctor. So the purpose of drinking, defecating and urinating, walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, and keeping silent. Talking. Do you talk too much? So there was one saying years ago. It was, if you can't improve upon the silence, be quiet. So before you speak, can you improve upon the silence? What are you talking for anyway? It's my job, I have to do that. It's not yours. You've got this wonderful opportunity to be quiet and silent. And silence is golden, it's beautiful. But we have noble silence sometimes. And when you have noble silence, everyone is trying to keep quiet. What happens in your cottage? Somebody speaks and says, be quiet. So, but now you're talking, and so are you. So how do you allow a person to reflect they've been talking too much? When they try and engage you in talking, they look at you and say, oh, you know, just, I noticed that, you know, you're sitting really, really well. What's the secret? Give them the one finger sign. That's the one finger sign in the meditation hall. Not the one finger from the middle. This one. And that means you're not breaking your noble silence, but you're encouraging other people to be quiet. But noble silence doesn't mean just always being quiet no matter what. Because, you know, sometimes, we do have a friendly snake which comes out in the hot weather. It's really a nice snake. Have you seen it yet? Okay. But, you know, it's totally venomous, totally dangerous. But it's really, really kind. And yes, it slithers around doing its thing. And it's almost part of our retreat center. So, anyway, if you see somebody and, you know, they are, you're keeping your noble silence and they're just, you know, checking their emails or messages or whatever, and then you don't just say, well, I'm keeping noble silence. Because you may not be very good as a mime performer. And before they understand what it is, you know, they've been bitten. You're in big trouble. So it's okay, noble silence doesn't mean stupid silence. So if there is something to say to a person, oh, just be careful, there's a snake over there. Then that's all you do. So you don't break into conversations. And by the way, you know, the reptiles are one of my hobbies. And the snakes, that's a very lovely snake. That's a particular species. I reckon by its shape, it's a male. And don't do stuff like that. Just, you know, keep the speech to the absolute minimum. But sometimes people would tell me, oh, you know, just, it's so impersonal on these retreats. You go on a retreat, you're not allowed to talk to one another. It's true, you're not allowed to talk to one another. You shouldn't really. You can if you want to, but I'm not going to punish you or anything. But, you know, take the opportunity for some peace and quiet. But if you see one another, noble silence doesn't mean you can't smile at one another. A little smile, that is just much better than so many, many verbal interactions. So that's one of the reasons why noble silence means you smile, you don't speak too much, and that you can restrain the speech if it's not improving on the silence. Now I've lost my place again, because I touch these things and didn't know what happens afterwards. Oh, it's down here. So we have, oops, no, not yet. We have rising, passing, that was up again, better than that, a bit more. Okay, bodily, So when you're full comprehension of the purpose of how your body is, in that way you're still aware of your body, of, you know, this thing we call a physical body. So you know that, you know, you need to drink, other people need to drink, you need to sleep, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little. You talk, other people talk, you keep silent, other people keep silent. And this way you're aware of your own body, or you're aware of that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours. You're quite aware of both your own and other bodies. And that's one of the reasons, when you realize other people are the same as you have lots of loving kindness towards them. You know, sometimes I do stupid things, say wrong jokes, or just mess them up. And what happens is, you know, other people do the same. So you just, you know, you give yourself more latitude. You don't judge other people so harshly, you don't judge yourself so harshly. You're at peace with yourself. And when you're at peace with yourself, you're at peace with others. It's just a body, that's all. And or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments. You abide aware the body will cease. You contemplate the arising and the ceasing, the causal nature of both arising and ceasing. Or else mind is just a body, with permanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation, and you abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. In this particular case, you don't cling to this body. If it dies, it dies. If it survives, it survives. That's just the story when I had scrub typhus in the first year in Thailand. An Ajahn Chah came to see me, and he was just, you know, this huge, great monk. And I thought, wow, he's made the effort to come and see me in hospital. And I felt so sick and tired and exhausted. And he came to see me. And you know, you are uplifted. You think, wow, the great master has come to visit me. And, oh, thank you so much. And you all know what he said to me. Brother Wong, sir, yes. You'll either get better or you'll die. He turned around and went. The worst thing about that, you know, he was correct. You couldn't argue with him, but you know, I just wanted a bit of TLC and just a bit of kindness and how you're feeling. Anything I can do for you, you know, I know it's really hard being, I know, that's what I wanted. But he just gave me what I needed. So, from that, if ever you go and see your mother in hospital is very sick, just go in there. Might be able to get better or you'll die. Bye. I've got to go back to work. Don't do that. Anyway, the bodily parts. Or you view your body from head to toe, bounded by skin, as made up of many kinds of parts, blood and bones, tissues and organs, just as though there were a full shopping bag with many kind of groceries, such as bread, potatoes, fruit and vegetables. So too we view this same body as full of many parts. In this body there are hairs, bones, shit and urine. That is another way you are mindful of the body. Now, how many parts of the body are there in traditional Buddhism? How many? Some say 31, some say 32. Which is the right one? In the suttas and the Buddha, there's only 31 parts of the body. And then somebody figured out they left out the brain. So in the commentaries and the Abhidharma, they had 32 parts of the body. So the original was a no-brainer. And anyway, who needs a brain anyway? It's causing so much trouble. Anyhow, so instead of saying, and sometimes you look at those, and if you studied anatomy, something, what if you lift things out? So it's just, this is one way, 32 parts, 30 parts, 108 parts, or whatever. It's just looking at this body
and it's just made up of all sorts of interconnected parts, blood and bones, tissues and organs. And in the original, they had just like a bag with so many different types of rice. And because, you know, that living in Australia, I thought, well, you know, people don't go to the grocery and just get rice. So I put in here a full shopping bag with many kinds of groceries, such as bread and potatoes, fruit and vegetables. It doesn't matter the ingredients. It's just it's different things which make up this body. And I put shit and urine in there just to wake people up, because sometimes when they... We can't say things like that. Now you're listening. You're mindful. All the elements. You fill your body by way of elements. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. That is another way that you are mindful of the body. In each one of these ways you are mindful of the body still has the what you have to do beforehand to have restrain the five hindrance, mindful, energized, remembering the purpose, and finishes off with, in that such a way you understand the what causes the body to arise, what causes the body to cease, and the arising and ceasing of the body according to causes. Where you arise, it's just the body, that's all. It's just it's like a shopping bag with so many kinds of groceries, or the bodily parts, or the elements, or the nine charna ground contemplations. Now, when some monks used to do this, they used to really get into this. I thought this was a bit gross. They would go, you see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, up to 3 days old, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. And even today, apparently, people love this sort of stuff. I've only seen photos, still photos. They've got zombies, walking dead, vampires, and all sorts of gross sort of depictions of the human body. But why is it? And I also remember that when you go and visit these temples, some of these temples, they have pictures of the hell realms, the human realms, and the heaven realms. But most people, they linger on the hell realms and all the different ways of people being tortured. It's really weird, human beings. Anyway, so you reflect your own body as of the same nature. Or you see a corpse thrown aside in a china ground being devoured by birds, animals, or maggots. You reflect that your own body is of the same nature, devoured by maggots. That's the way you say this. And people really get into this. You reflect your own body is of the same nature. You may become like that, it's not exempt from that fate. Or you see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews, a fleshless skeleton smeared with blood, a skeleton without flesh and blood, disconnected bones, bones bleached white, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbled to dust. You reflect your own body is of the same nature. You may become like that, it's not exempt from that fate. So in other words, you know, you're going to die. And your body, which, you know, people spend a lot of time sort of, you know, sometimes over-caring for it. And sometimes it means that you're not realizing this body is going to die. It's really weird. Now, why is it that, you know, people get grossed out of the different ways we dispose of people's bodies? And it's not really environmentally friendly to actually cremate bodies. And it takes a lot of gas or fire to cremate a human body, or, you know, to bury them in the ground. And you're going to get... People have some weird superstitions. You know, in Belfast, they had this sectarian violence between the Catholics and the Protestants. And in the main cemetery in Belfast, you know, they have the side for the Protestants and the side for the Catholics. And it's not just a wall between them above ground. They also made sure they created a wall underground. Was it 3 meters or something? Or 4 meters underground. So the worms from one side could not contaminate the bodies on the other side. And that's true. That's absolutely crazy. All right, tell a joke. Okay. So there was the when a person is, I think they've got every disease, the hypochondriac. The hypochondriac came into the doctor in the GP and said, "Oh, I think I've got cancer." And so he gave him all the tests. "You haven't got cancer." "Oh, okay." So he went out and then he said, "I think I've got Ebola." And they checked him, hasn't got Ebola. And he's saying, "Oh no, I think I've got mad cow disease. Jacobson or whatever it is, disease." Well, you know what I'm talking about. And he said, "No, you haven't." And every time there was a new disease came out, he'd see his doctor and said, "I'm sure I've got it." And after a while, it was taking up so much of the GP's time. The GP decided, "No, needs a bit of tough love." So when he came in, he said, "You know, he thinks he's got some other disease." The doctor really scolded him. "You haven't got any disease at all. You are one of the healthiest people who comes into this surgery. But the only thing is, you're a hypochondriac. You're just exaggerating things. You're perfectly healthy. You don't come into my office again. Get out." And he really just overdid it a bit because the poor patient was stunned. And he just walked out of the office just totally unmindful, just really sort of confused and stunned. And he walked across the road, got hit by a car and got killed. And of course the doctor heard the sound of the accident, the crash, and rushed out and saw this man lying dead in the road and thought, "I'm responsible for this." And the doctor died of a heart attack too, right there. So the GP and the hypochondriac were buried next to each other in the cemetery because they died just within minutes of each other. And his first night in his coffin, underground, the doctor heard someone knocking on his coffin. And you guess who it was? It was a hypochondriac. He said, "Doctor, have you got anything for worms?" Okay. Now don't go into details. You're dead, you can't hear anything, but this is a joke, that's all. So anyway, that's sometimes if a person... We used to actually be able to go to autopsies when I was in Thailand. And, you know, you see people who were sometimes dragged from the river, and they would look like monsters. You couldn't really relate to them. But then there was once I went going to an autopsy, and there was a person there, you know, who was almost the same age as me. And, you know, they weren't sort of some disease which made them look really terrible. They looked pretty ordinary. And when it's the same age as you and you see them there, and that really sort of affects you. You see that you could die any time. Not necessarily have to be old to die. And then see them cut up and just see what made them die. But I was always interested in that. Not really repelled at all. But in Sirirat Hospital, in the main pathology room, because you're a monk, you know, you could just walk anywhere. And so I remember going in there. And it's just like any lecture theatre. You know, you have the big slab in the front there where the coroner does his cutting up of the body. And you know, the lecture theatre was, you know, rising up, you know, the bleachers, and it goes up and up and up. And the windows, like here, were very high. But in front of one window, you know, where you'd usually expect a flower pot, I went up there, it looked like there was a human head up there. You know, cut off here. And I thought, "Oh, this is just a joke. You know, it's just like a plastic one or something." So I went up there and it was actually a real one. And being a monk, I thought, "This is cool." That's the sort of stuff they used to put up there. I don't know, you know, who lost his head and put up there, but it was a real head. But anyway, what that really does is just, you know, this body, you know, you make use of it, you care for it, but you know, you don't get attached to it. Just the body. Now, how healthy and strong, how pretty, how fit. It's just a body, that's all. So you make use of it, look after it, be presentable. In the end, you're going to get ugly and smelly and decrepitude. So you try and look after it, and then eventually you pass away. But all the rituals and fear around death, oh, just come on. It's just a body which has died. It's just an old car, and the driver's gone. So you just dispose of it whichever way you can. So all you do is, in this way you're aware of your own body, you're aware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, so you're abide aware of both your own and others' bodies. It's the nature to die, and that's what happens to you when you die. And you know, because you go to lots of funerals, this is not joke, this is real story. I go to so many funerals, you get to know the funeral directors in Perth. You know, Ajahn Bab, how you been? And he said, you know, I'm pretty good, so, you know, you can't get my custom. You know, I'm not going to go in one of your boxes for a while. And, yeah, you tell jokes to one another. And there was this one ceremony, it was a burial, and I knew the burial plot was a long distance from the, so I knew it was going to be a bit of a walk. You know, we were in front of the hearse, and the family were behind the hearse. I was talking with the funeral director. It was a woman, and I said, you know, how long have you been doing this now? She said, actually, I'm about to retire, another couple of weeks, and I'm retiring. And you've been doing this most of your life? I said, yeah, many years. I said, oh, great. You know, it's a long journey, a long walk to the funeral, to the plot where we do the internment, the burial. Have you seen any ghosts? I said, oh yeah, you know, that's what happens. And you see ghosts, that's part of the job. I said, really? No, just where? And she said this, and it was real for her, it wasn't sort of fake, it wasn't any joke. In the office, you know, where the funeral director is, they got the computers and the files and stuff, and round the back is where they have the freezers. So they put the bodies in the freezers, keep them cold, you know, and then they sort of bring them out for the ceremonies. And she said, no, quite often, you know, because, you know, she puts them in there, has to make sure it's embalmed, you know, she knows the person who's died, and every now and again she's busy typing on her computer and she sees a person walk past her office. It's a ghost. And she says, she gets so used to that, you know, seeing these people, that, you know, she tells them, you, back in your box. She's not scared at all. It's just part of the job. And the way she said that, hey, get in your box. So sometimes the monk has some really interesting stories, you know, just, and you know, I say, is that true? Yeah, oh yeah, that's true. That's what happens. Anyone want to get a job in a funeral? Anyway, so you buy, it's just a body, that's all. There's another way you're mindful of the body, so don't get attached to it. So the benefits of the mindfulness of the body, which are really cool. Number one, you overcome enlightened discontent, especially with your body. You know, body feels really good, but then it feels really awful. You get lots of energy, and then you're exhausted. You're healthy, and then you're sick. It's part of having a body, that's all. So delight and discontent, you overcome fear and dread. You can bear cold, heat, hunger, thirst, contact with flies, mosquitoes, ticks, wind, the sun, the creeping things. You endure unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful and menacing to life. This is just this body, that's all. So you've only got a certain amount of time in this body, make the best use of it. And when it dies, had a great time, wonderful time here, and then you just leave it alone. Just like, you know, sometimes they have I'll tell this joke tonight. So, you bear cold, heat, hunger, thirst. You experience, this is interesting. Because mindfulness of the body, it means, you know, you don't get too upset about the body. One of the little anecdotes is that when I started meditating, and I'd cross my legs, and after about 10 or 15 minutes, you know, my leg would fall asleep, as they say, get pins and needles. I think you know what I'm talking about. And so I got concerned about that. I didn't know too much about anatomy and medicine. I thought, oh my goodness, that means there's no blood going into my leg. If you don't get any blood going into your leg, soon it will get gangrene. And then soon you'll be able to, you won't be able to get up anyway, and you have to have your leg cut off. And that's the sort of the fear which I had as a maybe young sort of 18, 19 year old meditating. And of course that's a lot of gomayang, that doesn't happen to you. It's just, you know, the blood supply, I think, to the nerves on the surface of the skin is being cut off, that's all. Nothing much. And anyway, so one day, I said, I had enough of this, keep on moving my legs, it's because my leg go to sleep. I was a bit rebellious, I said, okay, I don't care, you can, you know, if when I come out of meditation I have to go to hospital and you have to cut off the leg, I don't care, I'm just going to sit here. And I didn't move, and just after about 10 minutes, actually the blood, or the feelings in the surface of the leg came back again, all by themselves, I didn't move at all. It was almost like, you know, calling the bluff of the body. Because sometimes when it's, oh, you better move soon. You're gonna die. You're gonna miss your lunch. Check the time. You don't miss your lunch. You know, it's amazing. You've got things like body clocks. You may not wake up in the morning early enough, you know, to do many things, but you'll always wake up for breakfast. Has anyone missed their breakfast yet? There you go, proof. But we have fear. And it's the fear of the, I've got to look after my body. Or even if you don't eat for a day. Oh my goodness, I haven't eaten today. I'm going to die. The body can do without food for a few days. So anyway, just, you know, you just don't be too afraid of the body. So that means you can let the body go more. And then number four, you experience whenever needed, without difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind, adichitta, and provide a pleasant abiding in this very life. And that is really sort of, first of all, this is a bit of a jump. You know, so, you know, you just mindful of the body, and then suddenly, number four, the benefits of mindfulness of the body, you can experience the jhanas. All it means is you can relax the body and you can let it go. Because that's the thing which creates the jhanas, the body vanishing and disappearing. And just, you can't feel the body. You can't hear stuff. And, you know, you're quite happy like that. You're not afraid. Sometimes people get, you know, really good meditations, you get some nimittas coming up, some lights, but you can still feel a bit of the body, you can still hear, you can't let that last bit go. Why? Because you're not ready. If I let my body totally go and disappear, who knows what might happen to it? It's this, you know, it's almost like yours. Have you ever had something very valuable and you keep it in your pocket, you're checking, keep on checking it, keep on checking it? Just like your body, you can't let it go, you keep on checking it. So when you can let the body go totally, the four jhanas, and because of the four jhanas, you can wield the various kinds of super normal power. Having been one, you can become many. Having been many, you become one. You appear and vanish. You go unhindered through a wall or through a mountain as though through space. You dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. You walk on water without sinking as though it was the earth. And seated cross-legged, you travel in space like a bird. You wield bodily mastery, even as far as the Brahma world. Is that cool? Having powers. And if you did have powers, would you demonstrate them to others? Do you want to see a power? There I was, I disappeared, and now I came back again. No, I didn't. You forgot about it. No, the, I already mentioned the story of the power of the, that monk who could hear sounds far away. There was this other monk. And again, we keep these secret until the person's passed away, so they don't get sort of harassed and harangued to demonstrate their powers. But that was that monk, you know, you may remember him, Sudarmo. He was an Indonesian monk, because I met him and he was, you know, the real thing. And he had this ability, you know, I won't go through his history yet, but, you know, he was a very powerful monk. And he was teaching meditation in Wat Bawan. And one of my friends was there just in his class. When everyone had their eyes closed, you know, sometimes you realize something's going on. So this woman, she was actually a princess, a granddaughter of one of the kings in Thailand. She opened her eyes and she saw, and she absolutely said, this is true, it happened. She saw these laser lights coming out of this monk's eyes into one of the meditators. This wasn't a movie, this wasn't special effects, this was real. And what happened after that? This monk with laser eyes, she was terrified. She never went back again. Sometimes that happens if you demonstrate powers that people are scared of you, terrified, real. Would you like to see your power? You always think, oh yeah, that'd be cool, but no. So with clairaudience, the divine ear, you hear sounds both heavenly and human, those that are far and what is near. You can read the minds of other persons, having encompassed them with your own mind, especially whether their minds are affected by one of the five hindrances or whether it's experiencing a jhana. You recollect your past lives, even up to 100,000 births, and many eons of expanding universes, many eons of decaying universes. There I was so named, of such a family, with such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there I reappeared in this other place. And there too I was so named, of such a family, such my life term, and passing away from there I reappeared here. Thus, with aspects and particulars, you recollect many of your past lives. So that, you know, sometimes comes with deep meditation. And if any of you ever want to try something like that, is, you know, it's not that hard to do, recollecting past lives. And people sometimes do that through hypnotic regression. You know, access the mind through hypnosis, and they get sort of amazing past life memories, which you check up. And yeah, you find out, my goodness, they were real. So even like recently, can't tell who the fellow was, but he had, you know, he was always wondering why it was that he, you know, from the time he was a kid, he knew how to fly a plane. He never had any instructions or lessons. By the time he was 6 or 7, he knew everything about planes and how to fly them. And that was really weird. But, you know, he had another job. You know, he didn't sort of go into the aviation industry, but he said he always knew how to fly planes. And then, eventually, just to try hypnotic regression. And it turned out that, you know, that he was a pilot in the RAF during the Second World War. And he was flying a Wellington bomber. I know the details of this. I'll tell you why in a moment. And just from Wales up to Gibraltar, just ferrying stuff. And the rudder of his plane got so damaged, and so he, you know, he couldn't actually land the plane properly in Gibraltar, and it crashed. And he remembered that with all its details. And that after, you know, he allowed me, because I knew him very well, he trusted me, to actually get a detail of his regression experience, an audio of it. And so I'm not that good at computers, but I was good enough one Saturday evening at Nolamara Temple, just going on the aircraft crashes, Wellington bombers, Gibraltar, and I found it. You know, where, you know, he'd actually, the details of the crash, as he said. So it was amazing when actually you find out, wow, that's true. You know, he didn't want to know about the details or the draft I found. He said, well, I know it's true because, you know, I can so certain of it. But the other way, in deep meditation, you say, what's my earliest memory? Which is really cool. What's my earliest memory? You go in there. What's my earliest memory? And sometimes you get your early life memories. And say earlier, please. The point is that if your mind is really, the five hindrances are gone, so very peaceful, very powerful, really strong mind state, and then you get your just one suggestion, earliest memory, and you get sort of maybe early life, earlier please, and then you get your past lives, really clear. But the warning of that is it's not much of a warning, because a couple of people tried that on these retreats, and they got their past life memories, and you get the closest memory to this life, the most intense memory to this life, is your past dying moments, which are usually, you know, not that pleasant. So a few people say, Ajahn Brahm, please don't tell people to do that anymore, because, you know, I sort of did that, you know, got early and early, I got into my past life when I died last time, and that wasn't nice. And so, please don't tell people to do that anymore, because you're actually re-experiencing what happened to you. You're almost like back there. So if that ever happens to you, just say earlier, please. So just, you know, just, it's like not lingering there, just like pressing the rewind button or the earlier button. That's basically what it is. So you go earlier into a more pleasant memory of your previous life. But you know, you can do that. The nice thing is now, there is usually enough records. You can actually go there and find out. You know, those memories you have, were they real? The names, the places, the details. And as always, you find things which you never expected to find. Knowledge, you know, which, you know, you couldn't have found any other place. And there it was. You recollect your past lives. Da da da. Who do you reckon Mr. Trump was in his past life? It'd be really interesting. Sue? Mr. Hitler? No. I better not go there, I'd be in big trouble. Please, no, delete that from the recording. Or, you know, once you recollect your past lives, then you can actually understand beings passing away and reappearing, inferior, superior, fair, ugly, fortunate, unfortunate. One understands how beings are reborn according to their actions. That is one of the stories. This is in the Dakkhina Vibhanga Sutta. Yeah, it's actually, and I tell this, you know, whenever you know you're in a place like Singapore, and people don't like asking questions. Because, you know, you're not supposed to ask questions of a teacher. So that's why, when I can't ask questions, I mention that the Buddha understands how karma works. And, you know, why is it that some people are born, you know, rich, and other people are poor? And sometimes you really work hard. You work, 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 and you're still, it's really difficult to pay the bills. There's other people, they don't hard work at all. And you know, well, the business deals always work for them. They win the lotto, they don't have any trouble, and they just, they don't work as hard as you. They haven't done as much study or work so hard. But still it's hard to make ends meet. It must be something from the past which make you rich or make you poor. And so the fellow went to ask the Buddha, the expert. He said, well, what's the secret for being wealthy in your next life? And what's the secret for, you know, why people are poor, the cause and effect? And the Buddha gave a really good answer. And then the next question was, well, why are people, some people are beautiful and other people are just ugly? Doesn't matter how many times they go to Korea for a facelift. They're still ugly. And other people are just beautiful. And I always mention this because when I say this story, I always look at the floor when I mention the word beautiful or ugly. Because you know what happened? I said this in Singapore in the Buddhist Fellowship once. You know, when I mention the word ugly, you know, you just happen, just by chance, happen to be looking at one girl. And did she complain? Why did you mention the word ugly when you were looking at me? So I put my head down, and even just, you know, just mention the word beautiful, keep your head down as well, in case people get the wrong idea. And then I thought, I just, you know, just whenever I mention those words, I look at a guy, and still it's a problem. Today's world. Anyway, so Buddha gave a good example of reason. Yeah, the reason for that is beauty, is because you have your precepts, you're a good person. Yeah, you're always kind, you never cheat on anybody. You know, you're always honest and truthful. That's the secret for good looks. And anyway, the last one was intelligence. Why are some people just so intelligent? And others, they go to school and university, they have to get extra tuition, and they have to redo the course. Eventually they get their degrees, but it's just so hard work. And that's where the Buddha said the cause for intelligence is asking questions. So if you want to be stupid in your next life, don't ask any questions. And that usually gets lots of questions coming up. People put their hand up. They go, oh, personal benefit of it. Anyway, one understands beings are reborn according to their actions. And by realizing for yourself the direct experience in this very life, you enter upon the mind and the deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom, you are an enlightened one. That's the best part of the mindfulness of the body. Any questions? You can always write them down this evening. Okay, so that's the mindfulness of the body. I've already mentioned arising and passing away, so we'll do a little bit of that tomorrow with the mindfulness of experience and see where we go to next. Sadhu! 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 Okay.
Very good.
The weather is warming up. The sun is coming out.